Welcome to the Sunshine Economy, Roasting in the Sun, the coffee business in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. 9/10 of a cup, not even a full drink. That's how much coffee per capita Americans drink each day. 9/10 of a cup of coffee. Now, the Dutch drink more than twice that. But more than half of Americans over 18 years old grab a cup of coffee each day. And Hispanic Americans drank twice as much espresso every day than any other group in the United States. Yeah, there's plenty of information on our coffee drinking habits. Those statistics come from consumer research firm Euromonitor and industry trade group, the National Coffee Association. Now, as a country, we are drinking about half the amount of coffee we were drinking just after World War II. Half. But today's 9/10 of a cup probably is a lot different than it was even a generation ago.
You know, I was probably about 5 or 6, and I think it was a sip of a cup of Sanka that my dad had, and it was absolutely putrid. And I couldn't imagine why anybody would want to drink something so nasty.
That's Christopher Johnson recalling his first cup of coffee. Now, he grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, one of the cradles of today's gourmet coffee industry. Today, he runs Eternity Coffee Roasters in downtown Miami. It is one of the specialty coffee roasters hoping to strike it hot in South Florida as coffee drinkers' tastes become more refined and more demanding. Robert Spuck started Kanya Coffee in Margate in 2010 after a career in the franchising business. He remembers his first cup of coffee not so much for the coffee, but what it represented.
I remember working, my father's had a business, industrial supply business, and I was working in the pipe shed, trying to build up my muscles for playing football and stuff in high school. And they would always have a coffee break in the morning. I remember going back, and I lived up in the Albany, Saratoga area, and of course, it was during the summer and the racetrack was open. So at coffee break, they'd bring out the coffee and be checking out the Armstrong to check out the horses. That was my fond memory. It was a bunch of people laughing and, you know, playing, enjoying the coffee. And some would play cards and, you know, what they could do in their 15 minutes, they'd do.
And that's really what the coffee business continues to evolve into, right? Selling a commodity, sure, but selling atmosphere. It's the aroma, the flavor, the feeling of that cup of coffee, a cafe con leche, an espresso. Maybe you're settling down with a cup right now, rushing to grab one, trying to finish it off before work. Send us a tweet. What's your daily coffee? What's your first memorable cup of coffee? Use the handle on Twitter, at WLRN, and the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Now, we spoke with three local independent coffee roasters about the commerce of coffee here in South Florida.
I'm Robert Spuck with Kanya Coffee. We started out as a small roastery, which we still are in comparison to most things. But business has been pretty good. We do sell through Sysco, which is a major food distributor to the restaurants and so on. And we sell through Fresh Market, which is certainly the high end of the market. That's where we've positioned ourselves. We don't sell retail at all.
Chris Johnson with Eternity Coffee Roasters. The cafe business is, we've been there for in downtown Miami for 2.5 years. And in the beginning, it was a bit lonely as we were the only kind of third wave or specialty shop down in that area. But over the past 2.5 years, there's been an exponential increase to the point that we're even thinking of where our second location is going to be.
Michael Gessler, Alaska Coffee Roasting.
Well, I mean, in Alaska, I started this business 25 years ago, and we're sort of an icon in Alaska. Been in coffee quite a long time. My sister lived in Miami. It lives in Miami. She's always been kind of interested in doing a project, so I agreed. And so we wound up in Miami about 3 years ago. And Miami's been an interesting market. We're starting to grow. I think we're getting a good reputation, for consistency and high-quality products and diversity of products.
I've been in the franchising business all my life and decided not to franchise the coffee business only because of competition and that kind of thing and the expense of rents and all those different things that go into it. The fact that we were involved in Sysco and it's worked quite well for us through that, and also the Fresh Market plus all the cigar shops. We market under a Cuban early 50s brand, And with the Latin invasion, we'll call it that for lack of a better term, people across the country seem to have an affinity for our theme. So right now, the cost of coffee's gone up about 15% to 20% in the last 2 months. So we are feeling a little bit of a squeeze, but being on the high end of the market, we certainly don't, we're not as price sensitive as 8 o'clock coffee or something like that.
You know, we typically buy expensive coffees to begin with, where we're not buying anything close to the C price or the commercial price, but, you know, much farther over that, and doing farm direct trade. A lot of them are short run coffee, so they're not necessarily coffees we're going to keep, you know, all year long or for 2 or for 3 years. You know, we may be buying, you know, anywhere from, you know, 5 to 15,000 pounds of a coffee, and when that's gone, it's gone, and then we'll deal with the new price of the coffees that we have at that point.
Well, I've been through quite a number of these different cycles, and the end of the day is our business model's always been like a microbrewery, basically selling directly. Motto of the company is celebrating coffee, the wine of the tropics, from farm to cup, celebrating coffee, the wine of the tropics. And the end of the day is I think people are accustomed to a certain level of pricing and quality, and we always make sure to pander on the end of quality, and people seem to not have resistance to pricing for quality.
Well, it's a new market in South Florida. It's one that's the real high-end specialty coffees have been, you know, in the San Francisco and Portland, Oregon area and Seattle for a long time. And down here, it's a very new idea where we're bringing coffees that have, you know, they're single origin, there's traceability back to the farms, the altitude, the soil content, even the families that own those specific small farms. And we're not buying by, say, you know, Guatemalan coffee for the sake of Guatemalan. We're buying by a specific farm, by a cup profile. So every time we get the samples into the roastery, we're going to do a small sample roast, and we're going to evaluate each of those coffees blind, without knowing the importer, the country, the farm, anything, and just evaluating what we're getting in the cup. And we're looking for the ones that really jump off the table. And we found that there's a niche market in customers that are looking for coffees that have notes of berries and oak and plum and things like that.
We're probably someplace between CJ and the national brand someplace, and the fact that we hire somebody to do that for us, but much more general. We look for a quality bean. We pretty much use things from Colombia, Brazil, and most of our Robusta comes from India or someplace along the 23rd parallel. Very difficult to get into the business and go up against 8 o'clock coffee or any of the big, you know, just they can bury you if they choose to. Well, we're in a niche market. I'll call it niche. Everything is size. We are not as detailed. We don't cater on that retail and become the third place for coffee. I mean, there's more to coffee than just coffee. There's, you know, gab, there's meeting, there's fun, and that's really what Starbucks brought to the industry.
And I was in business before Starbucks when they were just a company in Seattle. I mean, they got capitalized through .com. And the end of the day is, yeah, they talk the talk of third space. They command a lot of real estate, and obviously they've brought a lot of consumers into the a game, and the end of the day, I mean, people, it is about taste, and it is about providing people with quality products. So yes, Starbucks opens up the opportunity for people looking for cafes, and then you can compare products.
You know, they're kind of great for us because we're not them. You know, I mean, we give the alternative to what they do with the push button automated beverage production and the large corporate image that people are, you know, sometimes a little sour on, and truly the handcrafted beverages in the cafe. And what's been interesting since we began distributing in Whole Foods, you know, we're distributing in areas where the cafe doesn't exist, so people don't have really the identity of the roastery and the coffee shop that we have in downtown, and they're merely looking at the packaging on the shelf. And, you know, we do advertise that it's locally roasted, and there's a big, you know, large community that wants to have things that are produced locally, reduces the, you know, the fuels in the trucks from getting things produced in Seattle and brought to, you know, South Florida. It's done locally. They're supporting local. They're keeping the money local, and they're getting a much better product.
Yeah, if there wasn't for Starbucks, I would probably have no business. They changed the world. I mean, they have, and it's not all about coffee. It is a huge, huge industry because of him. And certainly there's a lot more consumers, and that's my hope, and I think some of my the people here, is that people will move from that mass demographic into the more quality. I mean, I'm not going to give you my opinion of Starbucks coffee, but very rarely do I go to a meeting that's not at Starbucks.
So there's a lot of really interesting aspects about the drink as a food, as a health product, and obviously stimulates thought. The chemistry of the coffee, clearly it goes across the blood-brain barrier, and it stimulates neurons and gives you thought, clear thought processes. So it's a very social product, and it and obviously then you create areas where people are social together on coffee, and that it obviously has great qualities like great food products do.
It creates an excuse for people to get out of their office, for the people that work from home, to get out of their home, for two people that, you know, just want to get together and have a little, you know, chit chat, and don't want to be, you know, drinking booze in the afternoon. I guess we're the daytime booze.
I think CJ hit it on the head. It gives us, those of us that have traveled the world, most of the world does take its time from a siesta to everything else to talk to each other. We don't seem to be able to do that unless we're drinking alcohol. Coffee has that stimulative effect, has that calming effect to allow us to sit down, go eye to eye, share our thoughts, wants, desires, and really be a person, and allows us to communicate. So coffee's more than just coffee from the Arabica section or the Robusta from India or whatever the case may be. And I think that the small roasters really bring that experience to a higher degree. We can all drink coffee and, you know, roast it through the thing for $4 a pound, but you're not going to really get that experience. And the cafes even bring more, get you out of the house.
We're a young and new industry that's still growing, and the consumer palate is still kind of changing. So we'll see where it goes from here.
Christopher Johnson with Eternity Coffee Roasters, Bob Spuck of Kanya Coffee Roasters, and Michael Gesser of Alaska Coffee Roasting. Three coffee roasters, all roasting here in the Sunshine Economy. Still to come on our program, Going Global.
For sure, Brazilian coffee was not considered to be quality, and now Brazil is considered one of the big qualitative leaders as well, but also importing premium coffee from outside. It is like selling ice to the Eskimos.
This is the Sunshine Economy, roasting in the sun, the coffee business in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Tweet us a picture of your morning get-up cup of coffee. Use the handle at WLRN with the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Pleasure, health, and sustainability. Those are referred to as the qualities, the so-called three virtues of coffee.
Pleasure, health, and sustainability.
That's Andrea Ely. If you drink espresso, a traditional classic Italian espresso, you recognize that name, Ely. Andrea is the third generation to run Ely Cafe as the chairman and CEO.
Until 15 years ago, coffee used to be a commodity. Not really different and not really qualitative. Now, pleasure is different. You have much better quality in your cup thanks to the better quality in the crops. You have more discovery. You can enjoy different single origins, different cause-related coffee. You have a better preparation system thanks to the proportionate systems. You do have better places where to enjoy coffee. So it became an experiential drink, and I think it's only the beginning of a new revolution like it did happen in wine. Similarly for health. Health is the second great virtue of coffee. After 10 years or 12 years ago, coffee has been understood as the number one contributor in terms of antioxidants in the Western citizens' diet. So antioxidant means preventative cardiovascular disease and some cancers. Third is sustainability. Relatively to many other crops, coffee is good in terms of carbon and water footprint. And this did already pay dividends. In the 80s and the 90s, the growth, your compound average growth used to be around 1.5%. Now is above 2.5%.
Mr. Ely, where's that growth coming from? Is that from the developed world or the developing world, opening up new markets for large global coffee suppliers?
In the last decade, they used to come mostly from emerging countries. So the leader of growth has been Brazil, which nearly doubled the coffee consumption. I think now is the number one coffee consumption, besides being the number one coffee producer in the world. But also the Far East and the Middle East did increase the coffee consumption. So China, India, the Middle East, South Africa, many others. In the United States, it grew 3% last year. It's very positive.
Many locations that you mentioned in the Far East have been traditional tea drinkers. Brazil is interesting. Tell us about the Ely opportunities that you're seeing in Brazil, because it's also a large coffee domestic producer for the rest of the world.
So Italy is Ely's second house. And as a matter of fact, my sister, who is the queen of the coffee growers. She really has maintained relationship with the growers community. She lives half of her life in Brazil. And it all started in 1991. For sure, Brazilian coffee was not considered to be quality, and now Brazil is considered one of the big qualitative leaders as well. It is one of the leading gourmet coffee producers as well. And this is also triggering coffee consumption internally, because Brazilians are people really loving beauty and quality and well done. So now they are discovering the wonders of high-quality coffee, and they have both self-consumption of the best Italian Brazilian coffee, but also importing premium coffee from outside. So paradoxically, it is like selling ice to the Eskimos.
Selling coffee to the Brazilians because of their domestic coffee crop and coffee industry.
And national pride.
Yeah. Andre Ely is the CEO of the international Italian coffee company Ely. You sell coffee in more than 130 countries across the globe. The U.S. is a significant part of that business. How is doing business in the United States for a company like Ely in the international coffee business different than other locations?
It's a passion. I would like to do more and more and more. We have been there since 35 years. We have been the company introducing espresso in North America. I don't know if our second home is more Brazil or the United States. Probably both are our second home.
In terms of after Italy and in the importance of those markets to the business. Oh, that's interesting. You've seen consolidation happen here in the United States in terms of large Fortune 500 companies buying up local and regional roasters, which has created the opportunity for small batch roasters. What do those small roasters face if they are to hope to become even close to the scale that Ely has been able to succeed at over two generations?
Well, coffee is a fragmented sector. It means that you have the brand, and the big brand, and big financial resource. You grow big, but you don't grow big in a way that you completely exclude from the market others, because there are not so many entry barriers in the coffee sector. So this is difficult to become large, and not too difficult to enter in the market, and maybe a local level, like the micro roasters, the small local coffee company popping up frequently. So that means that it's an ecosystem which is made of big animals and also small one. It's interesting because it's very diverse. And most of the time, these new entrants, they also bring fresh ideas, and they raise excitement and renovation to the category. So I see this evolution changing a little bit now, because besides having a brand in order to grow big, you also now need to have other critical assets like technology. I'm referring specifically to two possible opportunities. One is to play in the portioned coffee market, which is booming.
Is that the single-serve market, the so-called K-cups that are in the United States?
Exactly. Single-serve is booming, and then you need the technology. If you're not part of the kind of consortium of the K-cup, I mean, you have a problem. Unless you have another strategy, like we do, because we don't do this product yet. And then the other way, critical asset for other business is have your own places, your own cafes, your own shops. Traditional coffee doesn't grow so much anymore.
Yeah, you're
using. So this becomes a decreasing return industry for traditional coffee, and which usually leads to consolidations, because the bigger go out in order to try to make acquisitions, in order to maintain volume and maintain margins by big volume, by purchasing other companies. So I expect in the next 10, 15 years to have a quite a dramatically different industry, different landscape in the coffee industry everywhere, but particularly in North America and in Europe.
That's the forecast from Andrea Ely of Ely Cafe from Italy. Still to come on our program, bringing Cafe Cubano to Middle America.
They saw the opportunity, and when they first came to talk to us, what they saw in our product was the fact that we were the leaders of the industry, where we, with Cafe Pilon and Cafe Bustelo, we dominated probably about 80% of the, we had about an 80% share of the market.
This is the Sunshine Economy, roasting in the sun, the coffee business in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Cuban coffee is one of Miami's most recognizable features. You don't need to taste it to recognize it. It's usually in a white styrofoam cup, maybe just a dribble of brown liquid escaping through the top, or a stack of plastic thimble-like cups. Two brands in particular dominate.
Cafe Pilon.
Bustelo.
Pilon.
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 Bustelo.
Pilon is number one.
Bustelo.
But these two brands, so closely associated with Cuba, may be more American than you think. Here's WLRN's Wilson Sayre.
Cuban coffee has a sound, a taste, and a history. At small windows called ventanitas all over town, women like Vivian carry on childhood traditions begun in Cuba.
If you don't have Cuban coffee, you're not a Cuban. It's something that I was born with, and I was the first thing that I learned when I was a young girl was to make Cuban coffee.
But almost as often, you meet people like Kaylee Otto, a 26-year-old from Pittsburgh.
Okay, I compare Cuban coffee when I first moved here to crack. I had it for the first time. I was at work, and I hated my job. And this guy was like, hey, do you want some Cuban coffee? I had one shot of it. I had the best day of work ever, and I had it every day after that.
Cuban coffee is Cuban by name, but it's taken on a whole new life in America. For one, you might be surprised to know that Bustelo was actually founded in the Bronx. Pilon, though, did start in Cuba. In fact, a young Celia Cruz did a TV ad for the coffee. But the revolution forced Pilon to start anew in Miami. It was the early 1960s when the Sauto family, who had been in the coffee business for generations, bought Pilon, essentially starting with nothing but the name. Back in those days, the Sauto family sold Pilon door to door, like the milkman. The oldest son, Jose, would go off to classes at UM.
And then in the afternoon, I would have my little VW bug and had it loaded with coffee. It smells like terrible, you know, I mean, that coffee. And that was the same car that I used to go dating.
But even after a decade, Pilon was still struggling. In the early 1970s, Sauto was sitting in the office of a Winn-Dixie buyer.
And I said, well, we bought Pilon. And he said, oh, don't tell me you bought that. That doesn't sell. As a matter of fact, I'm ready to discontinue the brand from the stores because the sales weren't there.
This was a crossroads for Pilon and really much of the Cuban coffee we know today. To keep Pilon on Winn-Dixie shelves, Sauto convinced the store to put it on sale. and Pilon started selling. Around that time, the Sauto family stockpiled a bunch of coffee. This was just before coffee prices skyrocketed. We're talking quadrupled per pound. That hit other companies pretty hard, and the Sautos started to buy up their competitors, Café Estrella, Café Dial, and in 2000, Bustelo. Over time, Cuban coffee made its way into life beyond Cuba, beyond Little Havana. Miami as a whole embraced it as part of what makes this place run. Here's Kay Liotto again.
In Miami in general, everything happens late at night. When my friends would come into town, we would go and get Cuban coffee and have it before we went out that night and not get home till 4 o'clock in the morning and be fine.
In 2011, the Sauto family, whose very name was synonymous with coffee back in Cuba, sold their empire to Midwesterners for $360 million. Smucker's now owns Pilon.
It feels like we accomplished the American dream. We came in, we worked hard, and we felt we did it. You know, we felt, wow, this is what it's all about.
It wasn't just the Sautos that achieved the American dream. Pilon got there, too. The brand now rubs elbows with fellow Smucker's products, Jif Peanut Butter, Crisco, and the Pillsbury Doughboy. And that makes sense. Cuban coffee has become an American coffee. I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
Jose, Tom.
Hey,
it's nice to meet
you.
Nice
to see you. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you. How are you doing?
I caught up with Jose Enrique Soto last week. I called and asked him to meet me on Calle Ocho. He could pick the place. He chose Cafe Versailles, which no longer serves the coffee Soto and his family used to own.
Let's get some coffee.
You know, I can't drink coffee anymore.
Is that right? There's an irony in that.
Yeah,
huh?
It is horrible, man. It's horrible.
You heard him right. He cannot drink coffee anymore. One of the driving forces behind expanding Cuban coffee brands nationwide can't drink coffee any longer. Doctor's orders due to a sleeping disorder. But he can drink decaf. It's poetic justice for the son who had to resort to subterfuge to get his father to begin selling decaf Cuban coffee beans.
I walk into my father's office one day and I said, Dad, I think there's a product out there that we don't have in our line of products. And whenever I go into the stores, I see the product is moving more and more, and that is the caffeinated coffee. My dad looked at me like I was crazy, and he says, you know, that is not what we do. I mean, we make coffee, and then we make coffee a certain way, and that's how we're going to do it.
That was back in the mid-1980s. The coffee market was undergoing one of its many evolutions. But who's to argue with the president of the company, especially if he's your father?
I said, okay, end of the conversation. I left, but I didn't give up.
Instead, Jose Enrique Soto kept bringing up the idea of decaffeinated coffee. His brothers, who were involved with the family's coffee business, kept talking about it too. But Dad would not budge. Decaffeinated coffee was not going to be part of the Cafe Pilon business.
There's a gentleman who used to work for us, and his name is Abilio. Abilio, his job was, he was a security guy. But whenever my father got into the office, he would see that my father was parking the car in his parking slot. So immediately, the minute he saw that, he would go ahead and make a special cup of coffee from my father, from the roast that they just have made that day.
That daily cup served as the boss's coffee, but also quality control, since it was brewed from the daily grind. So the son hatched his plan.
I said to Abilio, okay, Abilio, what I want you to do is tomorrow morning, I want you to use this coffee that I'm going to give you here, and you prepare it exactly how you prepare it to my father. Make sure you make the best cup of coffee that you can make. Make sure it's very foamy. Make sure that everything is the way he wants it. And when you walk in, I'm going to walk in at the same time, and you leave, and I leave it up to me.
Now, understandably, Abilio, the security guard, was worried. He was an innocent accomplice in this scheme. So the following day, Jose Enrique Soto's father, the head of the company that owned Cafe Pilon at the time, drove to the office, parking his car, and the security guard, Abilio, brewed up his morning cup of coffee.
I walk into my father's office as he's getting the cup of coffee. He looks at me, good morning, Dad, how are you? And he goes and drinks a sip. And then he looks at me and he says, what are you giving me here? I said, how do you like it? And he says, no. I says, are you giving me a competitor's brand? Do you want me to tell you how bad this thing is? I said, no, I just want you to tell me how you feel about that cup of coffee. He says, it looks good. It looks very appealing to the eye, but it tastes like no good. I said, okay, Dad. if the doctor comes to you tomorrow and says, Mr. Soto, you can't have any more coffee. You can't drink it. You have a problem, whatever the problem might be, you cannot drink caffeine anymore. And this is your alternative. Would you like to have the opportunity to do that? Or would you like to say, I will never see a cup of coffee again? And my dad said, okay, go ahead. Get the damn thing in.
And the decaf business grew for about the next decade before leveling off. They were selling about $10 to $13 million worth of decaf coffee when the Sotos sold Cafe Pilon and Cafe Bustelo to James Smucker in 2011. Do you miss the coffee business?
I miss the excitement. I miss the, you know, the friendship with the guys who worked for, with me for many, many years. I don't miss the grind of, you know, showing up in the office every day. And, you know, you kind of get to a point, you know, after so many years that you need to enjoy your life a little bit outside. So, yeah. So I don't miss that, you know.
How did the coffee business and the roasting business change as you got involved with your dad's business and then had the good fortune to be able to sell it to a Fortune 500 company?
You know, there was a huge change in the business all the way from, if you go back to the 1960s when we first came from Cuba here. At that time, there was a lot of regional roasters in the Miami area. You had, you know, three or four regional guys who dominated the regular coffee, the American-style coffee business. In the Cuban coffee or espresso coffee, whichever way, which is basically the same type of coffee, there was nobody here. Everybody was, there was actually one little guy in Miami who was Café de Al. Other than that, there was nobody else. Of course, the Cubans started to come in after 1960. And as the Cuban population grew, the coffee roasting started to change also. Not because of it, but I guess it was happening at the same time. Some of the bigger companies started buying the smaller guys, and they felt that it wasn't a need to have a roasting facility in South Florida. So most of the roasting facilities left. At the same time that that's happening, some of the Cuban roasters started popping up, and Café Estrella started, Café Ideal was the one that was here before, Café Pilon had their own roasting place. This was before my father got involved in the company. But the funny thing was that as the Cubans came in, that roasting took place in Miami, and that, to me, it changed a little bit. And then the Cuban guys started to be bought out by other companies. We were one of the ones that were buying. We bought two of them. Café Bustelo, who at the time was owned by Tetley Tea, started to buy out, and they bought a couple of other small roasters. And I'd say by the 1980s, there was basically, the end of 1980s, there was only basically Café Pilon as a roasting company and Café Bustelo. Everybody else was gone. I think a lot of things happened after we sold our company to Smucker's. A lot of smaller brands started to pop up again. You know, they felt there was a need for some local roasters, and people saw what we did, and they kind of wanted to emulate that to a certain degree.
It almost created space again in the market for the independent small roasters, the small batch roasters that could get away with getting a business model together that involved, you know, only a few hundred pounds or a few thousand pounds.
It did. It certainly did. You have to remember that roasting coffee you can do on many different levels. You know, you can have a startup business with a 50-pound roaster. So this is becoming an avenue for people to start their business. You know, they put their ideas together. They have the dreams that they can build up a brand. And actually, because of the huge amount of Spanish people in the area, there's an opportunity for these people to survive. You know, also coffee, it's so important. You know, you get so many places like where we are right now, where, you know, you constantly go to these places to get a little cup of coffee during the day. So that maintains the business growing and active. You know.
The Smucker's purchase of the Bustelo brand and the Pilon brand, does that tell you that the growing appetite for Café Cubano in a generic sense is nationwide?
I think it does. There's no question about it. The Smucker company great company that they are, they like to concentrate their efforts in areas. And when they do that, they try to dominate a field. And you can see what they do in the coffee business. You know, of course, they own, you know, the largest coffee company in the United States and one of the probably the, one of the largest in the world. They also are the manufacturers of other brands of coffee that, you know, like where they have, you know, they kind of concentrated their power like that.
Yeah, best known for Folgers, which is just a gigantic brand.
Exactly. But they also love Dunkin' Donuts, you know, and they have a very long relationship with them, which is going to last for the next 40 or 50 years. So they tried to do that. They saw the opportunity, and when they first came to talk to us, what they saw in our product was the fact that we were the leaders of the industry, where we, with Café Pilón and Café Bustelo, we dominated probably about 80% of the, we had about an 80% share of the market, which it could be a twofold situation because on the one side, there's not that much growth in the areas where you currently are because you already own 80% of the market. But on the other hand, then what they saw was the fact that they could bring those products out of the main Latin areas of the country, you know, South Florida and the New York area, and with their strength all over the country, they could put the brand all over, which is what they have been doing.
Describe for us, Jose, what we have here at Cafe Versailles.
All right. Well, what you're going to drink is the typical Cuban coffee, which is served with a lot of sugar. I hope you don't have a problem with the sugar. Okay, it usually serves with a lot of sugar unless you specifically ask for it. You're going to get a very strong cup of coffee. You're going to get that creamy top that you see. That's very important. And that is a combination of the coffee, the way it is, the blend of coffee you use. It's a combination of that. It's a combination of how you grind the coffee. So the grinders in the places need to be kept in top shape in order to get the fine grind that you need. If you don't get the fine grind, then you're not going to be able to get that foamy top on the coffee. And number three, the lady who makes the coffee needs to know how to make it. In some of these places where you become a customer and they know you, they even know how you drink it. You know, you come to a place like this, and if, once you've been coming here for a few weeks, they're going to know that you're going to drink the coffee in a certain way. Here comes Tom, okay? He likes a little sugar, he likes more sugar, or he likes no sugar, you know. But what you're going to get right now is just a regular cup of Cuban coffee or espresso that has a lot of sugar on it. And you can taste it and see if you like it.
All right, we will do that. Okay. It looks gorgeous. That
let me make sure they gave me the cap. Darling, tú me diste de café now, ¿verdad? Sí. Sí. Mira que me metes en el hospital. Send me to straight to the hospital.
No, no, no.
Jose Enrique Soto, one of the former owners of Café Pilón and Café Bustelo. Still to come, making that cup of coffee.
And look at that crema. Is that beautiful? I just love to look at it. It looks so good. That's for you. Enjoy right. your coffee. I didn't offer you any sugar in it. I'm sorry.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Coffee is about routine. The sounds, the smells, the tastes, the wait in line, the wait in the drive-thru, right? Coffee is personal. A dash of milk. No, it's got to be cream. Half and half is okay. A spoon of sugar. Sure, we can pay someone to know our unique requirements, but at-home coffee brewing has rebounded thanks to two things, convenience and technology. But it still starts with the coffee beans. We met Linda Gassenheimer in her kitchen where she has two coffee makers.
What would make a great cup of coffee? The first thing, you have to have really good quality coffee. That makes a big difference. You want to make sure that the coffee is stored properly. Store your coffee in an airtight container and away from the heat, away from light.
So how do you create that strong coffee if it's not just add more coffee or add less water?
To have it ground, finely ground, because there's more surface area, there's more the water getting into the coffee. Also, if you want a really strong cup and you don't want to steep it a long time, it needs to be manually done. So these wonderful coffee machines that we all have, and I have right here in my kitchen, may not be right for you. Maybe a French press.
You talk about the fineness of the ground, and the finer the grinding, the more surface area there is for the water to interact with the ground coffee bean, and the more opportunity for a richer flavor for your cup of coffee.
When it comes to espresso, the water is supposed to be only 30 seconds running through that coffee. And the other thing is, which I always find surprising, and I learned this from Ernesto Illy, who was the godfather of coffee, he's fantastic, who told me years ago, there is less caffeine in espresso coffee than there is in a cup of coffee. 8 grams of coffee, from espresso coffee point of view, gives you 70 milligrams of caffeine.
Okay.
A 12-ounce cup of coffee will give you 200 milligrams of caffeine.
Almost three times the amount.
Because caffeine is water-soluble. The longer it's in the water, the more caffeine you have. And so that's a surprise. So you have this wonderful cup of espresso, and you think you're getting a good shot of caffeine. You're getting a good shot of good coffee. Now, we're going to do this again. All right, ready? Okay, we're good to go. Now I'm going to make you espresso. Here it comes.
There we go.
And look at that crema. Is that beautiful? I just love to look at it. It looks so good. And it makes the perfect amount in my little espresso cup.
It's great caramel colored with that crema on top.
And that's
that looks
you.
Marvelous.
That's for you. Enjoy right. your coffee.
Thank you so much, Linda.
I didn't offer you any sugar in it. I'm sorry.
So, Linda, that was the Cadillac espresso maker.
Right. And coffee maker and grinder and anything else you can think of. Yeah. It cleans your kitchen and everything else.
Tell me about the machine we're in front of now.
Okay. This is one of these automatic machines similar to a Keurig or whatever you have for automatic machine, that they have little cups that you put in. I happen to have here the Green Mountain coffee.
And Green Mountain was the company that popularized these single-serve makers and really just set the whole trend off. Very popular in homes, very popular in offices. You see them more and more. What about the quality of the coffee?
Well, you're going to taste it in just a minute. It's heating itself up. You can see, you can leave it already heated if you want. And when it's ready, it's going to let me make an espresso or a cup of coffee or a big cup of mug. I'm going to give you the mug type. You look like you need a mug type of coffee.
We've really gotten away from the days of stovetop
coffee
or percolators, haven't we?
Exactly.
Is that because of convenience? Do these make better coffee than what we were making just a decade ago, let alone a generation ago?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because it's the person behind the coffee making that would make the difference. In this case, it doesn't matter. It's the machine behind the coffee, so you don't have to worry about it. But, yeah, you remember the cone that you would have, and you'd pour the coffee through it and all. Okay, so now this is ready to brew, and I'm popping the Green Mountain coffee in, and I'm going to press the button. I'm going to give you a big mug of coffee. And it's brewing and going. So you'll decide. And here's your cup of coffee.
We have a big mug of Green Mountain single serve coffee. This one's very hot, too.
Is it?
Oh,
yes. Okay, be careful.
It's good. I would almost say it's too hot to taste at this point.
Okay.
But it's doing its business in terms of trying to, invigorate me, because it's the whole practice of the steam and the sound of the coffee and the smell of the coffee. That's a very bold coffee, I got to say. Linda, what do you think it is about coffee as a beverage that attracts so much attention, but yet I think it's fair to say we also, as coffee drinkers, kind of take it for granted every day?
Well, coffee has become so important, especially in South Florida. It's really important. It gets us going. It's something in the morning to get going. But, you know, surprisingly, tea is becoming very, very strong. In fact, stronger than coffee these days.
More caffeine in tea now?
I don't think it's the caffeine, because there's less caffeine in tea, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's just a warm drink in the morning. I think throughout the world, people drink more tea than coffee.
Yeah. I will say it was bold, it was rich, and it was fully caffeinated as well. Drinking coffee at home with Linda Gassenheimer. Still to come on our program, remembering that first cup. This is the Sunshine Economy, roasting in the sun, the coffee business in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. For coffee drinkers, there's not much that compares to that first sip of coffee of the day. The steam coming off the cup, filling your nose with the rich, maybe slightly sweet smell as you tip the cup to your lips in anticipation of that first taste. But coffee, let's face it, is an acquired taste, right? You know this as a kid, turning away from that brown, hot liquid with a bitter bite in mom or dad's hand. Coffee is a drink of adulthood. It signals seriousness and maturity. You can handle the heat. You can handle the strong flavor. My mom likes to tell the story of her cup of coffee, her first cup of coffee. Now, she was a small-town girl from the middle of America, the middle of Iowa, literally. It was her senior year in high school, and she had just turned 17 years old. She, my grandparents, and her cousin and aunt and uncle came to Miami for the 1956 Orange Bowl, Oklahoma versus Maryland. My mom then went on a cruise with her cousin, aunt, and uncle for stopping in the Bahamas. They then sailed to Havana. For a few days, they were greeted with soldiers. Mom asked what was going on, and someone told her, "You never know when there will be a revolution." Well, later, Mom and her cousin wound up taking a taxi and dancing at the Tropicana in Havana. The Tropicana in Havana. That's where my mom had her first cup of coffee. And she still drinks that cup of coffee today, two cups every morning for breakfast, back in Middle America, back in Iowa. Coffee has its roots in antiquity. It has its own traditions. The ingredients, the beans, the heat, the water, all leading to your basic black coffee. That may not change, but coffee consumers and commerce are changing. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
I'm talking to the shadow, 1 o'clock to four, and Lord, how slow the moments go, and all I do is pour black coffee, feeling low as a girl.